I got a text message picture from a friend of my son. And she goes, look who I'm with. And I'm like, what? Where are you? And my mom had taken him to go see my friend's dad at a pool and driving. And she was not allowed to drive with my child. And I got there and I said, where are you? And I show up and she's there drinking. And this is right after she got out of rehab. So she had drank and drove with my child. I was livid.
Ever feel like you suck at this job? Motherhood, I mean. Have too much anxiety and not enough patience? Too much yelling, not enough play? There's no manual, no village, no guarantees. The stakes are high. We want so badly to get it right. But this is survival mode. We're just trying to make it to bedtime. So if you're full of mom guilt, your temper scares you, you feel like you're screwing everything up, and you're afraid to admit any of those things out loud, this podcast is for you. This is Failing Motherhood. I'm Danielle Bettman, and each week we'll chat with a mom ready to be real, sharing her insecurities, her fears, her failures, and her wins. We do not have it all figured out. That's not the goal. The goal is to remind you, you are the mom your kids need. They need what you have, you are good enough, and you're not alone. I hope you pop in earbuds, somehow sneak away, and get ready to hear some hope from the trenches. You belong here, friend. We're so glad you're here. Hey, it's Danielle. I can't wait to dive into today's episode. But before we do, I want to make sure you noticed an exciting update. There will be mini episodes out on Thursdays now. So Tuesdays will remain interview style, and then Thursdays will be a short topical talk with just me, diving deep into one reason contributing to our feeling of failure and how to face it. These are going to be so fun and actionable. So if you hadn't refreshed the feed until today, go back and do not miss the episode I shared last Thursday called How to Change the World. I poured my heart into this little soapbox episode, and I really want you to be on board for the mission. I share my story, more about wholeheartedly, and how we can work together to create a better world for our kids to adult in. Let's face it, until I can spend 4 hours trying to figure out how to do an Instagram reel, podcasts are going to be my happy place. So plan on meeting me back here each Thursday. My guest today is Jamie Cooper. I'm so grateful for her willingness to be so upfront, honest, and open about a delicate area of mom life, boundaries with grandparents. If you've ever struggled with feeling guilty by laying down a boundary for your family amidst extended family, this episode is for you. Even more so if you're navigating divorced parents, and even more so if you have alcoholism in your family. I hope it leaves you encouraged and empowered. Let's get to it. Welcome to Failing Motherhood. My name is Danielle Bettman, and on today's episode, I'm joined by Jamie Cooper. Jamie has her bachelor's in child and adolescent development from Point Loma Nazarene University that she finished while pregnant with both her littles. Her husband is a firefighter, and they were both born and raised in San Diego. She taught preschool until she had her youngest and is now a stay-at-home mom. And she's here today to share more of her story of what her home life looks like and how she relates to that idea of failing motherhood. So welcome, Jamie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited that you're willing to share your story with us today, because originally we connected on Instagram.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Desperately reaching out for help.
Because motherhood is hard.
Yep. Absolutely.
So tell us about your family. Who do you have at home?
So my husband, Corey, I have Gavin, my oldest, who is 3.5, and Maddie, who it will be 1 on July 5th.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yes.
That's so fun.
Yep. We also have a guest house where my 86-year-old grandmother lives. So we are one big happy compound over here.
And so has COVID made that scarier for you, or how are you handling that with her?
Yeah, I had to lock her in, basically. She's a very independent, young at heart, 86-year-old. So she was very confused and very upset why HomeGoods closed and TJ Maxx and Marshalls. And so we had to sit her down. You know, my husband being a firefighter paramedic, we had to sit her down and really like explain the severity of the situation and that she needed to be safe and not leave. And if she needed things, we went out and got them for her. And, you know, as things calmed down a little bit, she's been going out more. She made a really nice friend and they go garden in her garden in her yard. So that gets her out. So it's really nice for that. But yeah, at first it was like, it was very, very scary, very overwhelming. And for everyone, you know, my husband would come home through the garage, strip down, go take a shower before he touched the kids, said hi to anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was... it was pretty intense for a while, but things are starting to calm down in California here a little bit. So it's good.
That's good.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. All of the unknowns and all of the just craziness that we're living through right now is added challenges on top of the day-to-day normal.
Yes. And schools being closed and parks being closed and the outlets are no longer there and the kids are climbing the walls and
literally. Yeah, so no pressure. Just
not at all. It's fine. Doing that.
So have you ever felt like you were failing motherhood?
Every day. I always knew I wanted to be a mom. And I had in my mind this mom that I was going to be. And then reality hits and your kid is not the kid that you used to babysit when you were 16 years old. And both my children are very, very strong-willed, and very, very smart, like smart to the point where it is scary. They challenge me every day. And the amount of Chick-fil-A we eat probably isn't good, but you know what? We balance it out and we make it work. And, every day I go to bed and I just think about the ways that I could have done better and wake up the next morning and just try to do better. And that's all I can do. And I know that I'm doing a good job because of that. So.
Yes. Good. I'm glad that you have that truth that you're reminding yourself of every day. Did you feel like you had more pressure to perform with the degree that you have?
Absolutely. My husband, when we first had our first, he was like, well, you're the expert. What do we do here? And I feel as though, I did know a lot, like, you know, birth through a year, 18 months, it was a piece of cake, just, you know, like their immediate needs and challenging them in their age appropriate ways. But now that this 3.5-year-old stage and the little tiny manipulation that we have going on with him, it is pretty intense. And I'm constantly seeking advice and help. And I know what's supposed to happen. I know what we're supposed to do, but that doesn't happen. Right. And then you're, you know, you say, oh, well, when this happens, you're supposed to respond X, Y, and Z. And then you respond in X, Y, and Z and you don't get the results. And then you're overwhelmed and then you just spiral. And then your day is just this big giant mess and you have to take a step back and reel it in. And my husband is still constantly looking at me for answers, but I'm now looking at him for answers and we're bouncing ideas off each other and really trying to work together to figure out what works best for us because our dynamic is so different. You know, I am the caretaker 80-90% of the time because he's gone for 24-hour shifts. Sometimes up to 3 days at a time. So that presents a whole challenge in itself is when I'm the main caretaker, he comes home, the kids challenge both of us and tend to challenge me way more because I'm the one who's always there. Mm-hmm. But so it's hard because, you know, he comes home and, well, what are we, you know, what's the program? What do we do? And it's changing. It's ever changing. So
right,
it's like one day something works, the next day not so much. So
yes, you're back to the drawing board.
Yep, absolutely. But having the background, having the degree, it was so beneficial. I do want to do more with that eventually. So it was kind of like the baseline for my future career goals. But yeah, the pressure was there. And, oh, you know what you're doing. You've got this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sometimes.
Right. Whatever the textbook said did not cover whatever my kid just did. So
absolutely. And I can't run it. I can't rush through it real quick. Let me pull up my essays and look through.
Right. Yeah. And I feel like the kids in a classroom setting that aren't yours is a totally different dynamic in the relationship than it is when you're with your own kids 24/7.
100%. Would you agree? Yes. They challenge you. They know the buttons to push. They know what they can get away with. But, you know, these children that you teach and they respect you as a teacher, they respect you as an adult, a figure that is not their parents, that they know that they can push around and, mm-hmm. and they know what they can get away with. You know, there's set rules in classrooms. There's routine and kids thrive off of that. But then once you get home, routines don't always go well and they don't always go right, especially when you add another baby into the mix. And then it just turns into the control's lost. Whereas mm-hmm. in a classroom, there's much more control and kids love that and they thrive off of it as much as they probably don't, you know, act like it. They do. And it's good for them. They really, really thrive off of it. And so being a teacher is much easier than being a mom.
Yes, which I feel like we need to normalize that idea, because not only do us teachers that become moms have complexes, but we also look to the teachers that are our kids' classrooms when they say, oh, yeah, we never see that behavior. And, you know, they're just so wonderful and, you know, with me. And us as parents go, I'm sorry, what? Because that's not what I'm seeing at home. And we're like, clearly the problem is me. And that's not always true. They're just a totally different person with us.
Yeah. And then the frustration comes in because you're like, well, why? Why? Why with me? The person that loves mm-hmm. you most in the whole world. Why? Why? Why are you doing this to me?
Seriously. Yeah. And we're supposed to take it as a compliment because they're the most comfortable and safe with us. And because we have that secure attachment, it's a very good thing. But it really sucks.
Totally. But I've always said, as being a teacher and being a mom, I would rather have my kid come home and challenge me all night, every day, until the end of time, and go to school and really be able to respect and do what's asked of him and be kind to the other kids, because I'm okay. I love him unconditionally, and I will always be there for him, and I will always be the one that can deal with the challenges. But that teacher, that's not their kid. That's not their flesh and blood. So please go there and give them an easy time. Yes. Save the hard time for me.
Yes. That is a really good perspective to have, because we do really want them to thrive and succeed in those environments that are created for them, that we're paying people for.
and that they're not getting paid very much for. So
no, which is another huge problem we can go off.
Yes, exactly. We could start a whole new episode just on that.
Yes. The childcare industry and all of its problems. No. Yes. Another episode.
Yep. Next time.
So I do feel like there still is the question of, well, if they can turn it on at school, they should be able to act like that at home. And why can't they? And we need to, you know, get on them for that level of respect and obedience and, you know, first time compliance. And how do you feel about that? Like, do you have that impression at home?
Yeah. And the thing is that I know it'll get there. I know that things will get easier. Another set of challenges will get different and change and be harder, but the compliance will get there. And there's also such a fine line between wanting your child to be completely compliant and having them have a strong sense of self and independence, because you don't ever want to filter or smother that fire inside your child. And I think it's really hard to find that fine line of, no, you can't hit your sister in the head, but I understand that you are very passionate about what you were doing, and then you're upset that she knocked it over. Mm-hmm. So there's certain things that, yes, you cannot do that, but I understand why, and let's try to figure out how we can better express ourselves and better express our frustrations. And, you know, kids, you don't want them to just become a rule follower. You know, we want to raise this next generation of kids that are going to break through the mold and really challenge things and really challenge maybe old ways that are the way that things are done that shouldn't be done that way anymore. And we really want to make them be the next generation of rule changers for the better good. And if we're raising children that are constantly doing what we're told, what they're told all the time, they will become just a follower. And we don't want that. We want to raise leaders. And so there's such a hard, where do you go? Where do you start? How do you do this correctly? There's no right answer. And that's the hardest part about parenting. There's no rule book. There's no right answer. And we just have to navigate it day by day, second by second.
Yes. Yes. Because we make those jokes about like, well, they're either going to be the president of the United States or the president of the jail. Because, you know, we'll see where this leadership bossiness takes them. But the more that we can trust our kids and see the good in their strengths and believe that they have so much potential to lead, if we cultivate those strengths in a way that really, you know, influences that for the good, then yeah, they're going to be great. They're going to be amazing citizens that are kind and, you know, all the things we want them to be to their fellow brothers and sisters. But yeah, it all definitely starts young, and it is really hard to walk that line of, I can't let you do this, but how do I help you solve this problem together with me and find a better way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So,
that was a whole tangent.
Yes. Good tangent, but tangent.
Good tangent, yes. But I want to hear more of your story in your navigating your relationship with your parents, because that's kind of specifically how we connected and you reached out with the added challenges of not just parenting your kids, but having to really advocate for their safety in some ways and learning and growing yourself. So where did that start? Tell me more about your parents and all that.
So both my parents are alcoholics. About 8 years ago, they separated. And about 5 years ago, they got divorced. But the divorce still isn't final. It's still kind of one of those things that is, or it is final, but the legal battle is still going on. So there's a ton of turmoil. And they are both alcoholics, and both their alcoholism had kind of come to a head within the past 10 years, 8 years. My dad went to rehab probably seven or eight years ago, and he did great for a really long time, and then not so great. And the ebbs and flows of addiction are just very, very prevalent with both my parents, as they are with almost every addict. And so then my mom went to rehab about 2 years ago in September, and the alcoholism and the challenges that it's faced with me and my kids is just creating healthy boundaries between letting my kids be affected by this and where to go. Like where do we go? What boundaries do I set? My dad and mom have always drank, socially, probably maybe a little too much when I was younger, but recently just went kind of blew up. So my dad has always been a drinker. His alcoholism and his rehab stint was kind of forced upon by my mom during their separation. And then it didn't really work. It didn't go well. The sobriety didn't last. And the divorce kind of came through, and my dad has been on and off drinking. And my dad is the alcoholic that will admit when he's drinking. You will ask him straight up and he will tell you. And he feels so guilty about it, feels so like sad, but he will just drink. Like he will just drink. And there was one time when I went and picked him up from my mom's house. When they were separated, he was doing some painting for her, and they weren't living together. And I called him because I was over for dinner at my grandma's, and I was like, where are you? And I called him, and he was very intoxicated. So I had to drive and go pick him up at my mom's house, who wasn't home. and bring him home because he was so drunk. If he was going to drive, it was not going to be good. And you know, at that point is when I realized, like, I am not a child. I'm not their child anymore. I am an adult child that I'm an alcoholic. And essentially I have parents who I am parenting. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is a weird, weird, it's a weird situation. And it was weird to kind of be accustomed to. Fast forward, I had my own children. And I always had in the back of my head the alcoholism, and it's not, you don't know when they're going to be drinking. My mom, her alcoholism was a little bit more hidden. I think that she was drinking so much that I had just become, it was just her normal, and I didn't really realize it. You know, a lot of people told me, you know, your mom's drinking, and no, that's just how she is. That's just, and I made a ton of excuses. And she would watch my oldest, and they actually had a really good, great relationship. And she would come over all the time when I would go to work and even just go do something, and she would watch them. They would go for walks, and you know, the drinking kind of kicked up, but she was never driving with him. She was never allowed to take him in the car, which I already set that boundary very early. And we were on a walk one day in the stroller, and we were at the little corner store, the liquor store, getting some popsicles. And my mom used to walk there with him and get him popsicles and get him snacks and whatever and go on the walk. And we're at the level of the counter. And in the counter is a bunch of mini bottles of alcohol. And he's probably like almost two, and he's talking at this point, like talking pretty well. And he points at the liquor bottles and says, "Nanny," because that's what he called my mom. He said, "Nanny, nanny do that." And I was like, "What, buddy?" And he points right at the liquor bottles and goes, "Nanny, nanny do that." And I was like, oh my, what? And I was in like shock. My jaw dropped to the floor. I walked home. I called my sister immediately and was like, "You're never going to guess what Gavin did." And she was like, "Oh my gosh." Called my husband, called my grandma, the one that lives with us, who's my mom's mom. And she was like, "Oh, honey, that's not good." So that's when we kind of started the process of being like, okay, you need to get some help. Like, this is not good. So she agreed, and she went and got help. And then about 2 days or 3 days, maybe a week after she got out of rehab, she wanted to spend some time with Gavin. So I said, absolutely. And my husband and I hadn't been out, so we went out and got dinner, and she had him. And then I got a text message picture from a friend of my son. And she goes, "Look who I'm with." And I'm like, "What? Where are you?" And my mom had taken him to go see my friend's dad at a pool and driving. And she was not allowed to drive with my child. And I got there and I said, "Where are you?" And I show up and she's there drinking. And this is right after she got out of rehab. So she had drank and drove with my child. I was livid. And so I picked up my son. I put him in my husband's car, and then I got her, and I was like, this is it. You're done. You cannot be with him at all. Like, you, mm-hmm. You have put his life in danger, and that is unacceptable. And I know that my mom to this day still like regrets that, like will never forgive herself for what she's done. And I forgive her, but I do not forget. Mm-hmm. So therefore the boundaries that are set with my parents, they're not allowed to be with my children alone. If they do want to have them over to their house, or they want to come here, their significant other has to be with them, so that there is, you know, some sort of buffer and some sort of safe space, because I do trust both of my parents' significant others immensely. And I think they're both great people. So I trust them. But it's scary. And it was a scary thing to realize that, okay, this is no longer something that just affects me. And right. this is something that affects my kids. I have to make sure my kids are safe. Mm-hmm. And from then it has just become an uphill battle of trust and consistent disappointments that don't stop. And lies, a lot of lies. You know, covering up drinking, covering up reasons for drinking, erratic behavior, outbursts, more lies. And it's just challenging to try to figure out how to give your kids a great relationship with their grandparents without fracturing it completely. Yeah. Because you want them to have that. and you want your parents to be involved in your children's life, but at what cost?
Right. Because I'm sure it's even harder for you, having had good memories of your parents growing up, that you remember that and you want that for your kids. And that's not existing.
That is something I say to my husband all the time, is that I remember the best of times. I had a fantastic childhood. And my parents were both great parents. And I knew that they would be great grandparents. And they are fantastic grandparents. But addiction is something that comes above all else, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The alcohol is more important than a lot of other things in their life. And addicts will say, no, it's not. No, it's not. But the choices that they make and the actions that they do prove different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an adult child, like, I'm no longer obligated to follow their instructions and tolerate their, like, unacceptable behavior. And it's hard. Like, how do you keep your boundaries without standing up to your parents and feeling like a complete jerk or not feeling guilty? Because, like, I do feel guilty. Like, I want more than anything for my parents to have fantastic, trustworthy, healthy, loving, beautiful relationships with my children. But unfortunately, at this time in their addiction and their hatred and angst towards each other through this divorce and this legal process that's still going on, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. It's just a constant battle.
Mm. There's so much of aspects of that you have to grieve through, like, you know, all the stages of grief of not only your relationship with them and what you had, but your kids' relationship with them and all of the disappointment and having hope and love for them still, but needing to detach for your own safety, for your own sanity, and, you know, feeling misunderstood when you have to draw a boundary that makes you feel like a jerk. Like, there's so many levels of hard to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the guilt that comes along with, you know, trying to protect your kids, which is the number one thing that you need to do in your life, is protect your children. Yeah. The guilt that I feel is overwhelming. And it's crazy that is, like, that's my challenge as a mom. Yeah. I have to protect my kids, not only their physical well-being, but their like emotional well-being as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being a codependent, you know, trying to not be a codependent and not make excuses for them and have these strict and healthy boundaries and putting my feelings first and my family first and not taking responsibility for all their actions is challenging. And, you know, having some sort of, like, self-care and really having that grasp of taking care of myself and my family and realizing and getting over the fact that that does not mean I'm selfish, mm-hmm. is challenging. And it's challenging for a lot of people to understand. It's challenging for my parents to understand. It's challenging for my parents' friends to understand why, you know, when they see my in-laws with the kids all the time, but my parents aren't with them. It, you know, you only see what's on the surface.
Right.
So it's hard. But it's become a really, really, momentous thing for me to, a monumental thing for me to really grasp that taking care of myself and my family does not mean I'm a jerk and mm-hmm. does not mean that I'm mean. Mm-hmm. I'm just taking care of my tribe.
Yeah. So how did you come to that conclusion? How did you grow to be able to embrace that?
I have no idea. I think that it was just, there's so many straws and then one just breaks the camel's back. And you realize that you're trying to give chances after chance after chance, and you're making excuse after excuse after excuse. And you have to take a step back and realize this is not going to change. Mm. So my number one thing that I need to do is to take care of my own. And take care of myself, because if my mental state and my mental health is not aligned, none of my children's will be, none of my family's will be, and I will be worthless. So I need to take care of myself before I take care of anyone else. And so that form of self-care for me, whether it be, you know, not answering the phone in the evening when I know someone's been drinking, or not, you know, digging into the mind games and the manipulation and the arguments and the fights that ensue, like just not even participating in it, just shutting it down, makes things so much better, and makes me able to take care of me to where I can take care of my kids. And once I started doing that, that's when it made me realize that I'm not mean. I'm just doing my best. I'm not selfish. I don't hate my parents. I love them. And I think that this shows more love than anything, because I love them so much because I'm not willing to get into it with them, because I want to just keep things as copacetic as possible and just move forward to the best that we can until another slip up or another disappointment hits. And then the boundaries, you know, the boundaries come back into play because they're always there. But it's challenging every day. It's an everyday challenge. So
yeah. How often do you talk to them, and what are those conversations like? Like, do they give you a hard time? Do they make you feel guilty for the boundaries you put up?
Yes. And you know, the boundaries are kind of, how do I explain this? I've never sat them down and been like, these are my boundaries. But they know. So they understand. And my mom doesn't live here. And so I talk to her occasionally. We call, but we don't get into anything too deep. She wants to FaceTime with the kids, and that's great. You know, but then sometimes things start to spiral, and she starts talking about my dad and his girlfriend, and then the anger starts, it just spiral, and then it's okay. I gotta go. I can't talk about this. Like, I've asked you not to talk to me about this a million times, and then, you know, you hang up and don't talk to them for a week because it just became this huge blow up. So there's a fine line between how much you can really talk to and about. So conversations with us are very shallow. There's not a ton of depth to them. Same with my dad, but my dad lives here, so it's a lot easier. I feel like when I see him, you know, I see him more. He drives by the house and we talk. And the other day was the first time, actually, and my son is 3.5. It was the first time that he got to go over there and spend some time for a few hours, probably about 4 hours. And my dad's girlfriend was there, and my grandma was there, who's 93. And my grandma's roommate, who's one of my brother's friends. So there was, you know, it was like a group, group effort, but my son had a blast. He had so much fun, still talks about it to this day. My dad got to do things with him that we used to do as kids. And I love that, That made my heart so happy. That made me really just appreciate what could be. And all I can do is like hope that things can stay the way that they are. With my mom, it's much more challenging. My mom has autoimmune disease, and so she's sick. So her drinking with the sickness is just not good. And she lives in Arizona. So I don't see her. I talk to her as much as I can, but I don't see her. My mom and I used to be super close, but our relationship now has become somewhat of just my kids. Where my dad and I, we've always been close because he's my dad and I love him, but our relationship, you know, it's different as a mom. Your relationship with your mom and a daughter is we were so close. And so I definitely grieve the relationship with my mom a lot. It's challenging, but it's something that has to be done. And I feel like since I have not put up with the drinking and I have put up these boundaries to where I have to take care of myself and not answer the phone, I've been much happier. My kids have been like, I'm able to function much, much better. It's hard because you see the text message, you see the phone call, and you feel guilty not answering. You feel guilty, you know, not replying back right away. But when you take a step back and realize, like, do you want to get into it? Is it worth it?
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Hey, friends. Just checking in. How are you holding up? I mean, there's only a global pandemic, a worldwide health crisis, and the most insane school year with no winning solutions on our shoulders. Are you paying close attention to your mental health? Your mental health has a direct effect on your child's mental health. You can't give them what you don't have. Asking for help is a sign of courage, humility, resourcefulness, self-awareness, and honesty. All things we want to be teaching our kids, right? We have to lead by example. If you're not about to find a local therapist, have you heard of BetterHelp? They are a sponsor of this podcast, and they're here to help. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. BetterHelp will assess your needs through a questionnaire and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Their counselors are legit. Licensed, trained, experienced, accredited psychologists, marriage and family therapists, clinical social workers, or licensed professional counselors. And BetterHelp is committed to helping you find a good match, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. Accessible for clients worldwide, and financial aid is available. As a special offer for Failing Motherhood listeners, you get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/wholeheartedly. Visit betterhelp.com/wholeheartedly to get the help you need today. Your kids need you whole. Okay, back to the show. Yeah, I know one of the things that's easy to struggle with as a codependent is what is loving, because you still see the person that they were and can be and are under the alcoholism, and you have so much hope for that person and love for that person that the way that you want to treat them wants to be respectful to who that person really is. And yes. So I know that for me, what I struggled with is how do I show this person I still love them while also looking out for my sanity and my safety in a way that needs to be a priority. And it's very hard to kind of navigate that line because it's different for probably every situation and relationship of like, what do the boundaries need to be? What do the conversations need to look like? How blatant, how often, you know, like there's no exact rubric or formula for that. And so because it's so ambiguous, it can be a very deep hole to sink into of, you know, just being overcome with that overwhelm or that guilt. And what I learned by someone else pouring into me some insight was that the most loving thing I could do is to let them experience the consequences of, you know, living life on life's terms and not getting in the way, good or bad, you know, like enabling or excusing or, you know, causing more harm, but just like being as hands-off as possible is the most loving thing I could do. And that was hard to embrace.
Yeah.
But have you seen the good from that play out?
Yeah, I think that in a lot of cases when there is a relapse or an outburst or an argument or a blow up of any kind, I have been able to be much better about ending it, not talking. And then, you know, a week to whatever comes around and things are calm. You have a clear head. They have a clear head, hopefully. And, you know, one thing that I have really tried to embrace is not rehashing stuff.
Mm.
Because sometimes when it comes to the alcoholism and the anger and the manipulation and the outbursts is they don't remember it. Yep. They don't remember what they said. They don't remember what they did. And so rehashing it is just like reliving it. It's going to bring up some traumas and it doesn't make any sense. So the only thing I can do is remember my boundaries, keep them in place, and try my best to just love them and, and just have some grace, try to have as much grace as possible with them because I don't have that problem. I don't have that addiction. So I don't know what they're going through. I have no idea. But just to love them and to really try to stop and end it and come back to it in a few weeks or a couple days or whatever. Don't continue the texting wars, the guilt trips, the everything, because it's just a mind game and it can really throw you off for the rest of the day, the rest of the week. So I've really tried to just, when things happen and relapses happen, and you just end it. Just don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the other day I came home from, I was working in my mother-in-law's store and my mother-in-law had my kids and my dad's car was here. And I was like, what is he doing here? And I guess he had gone in the back to talk to my grandma or something. And I came out and he was hammered, drunk, and was really pissed off because my mother-in-law was with the kids and he doesn't get to have the kids, but then he's drunk. So I'm like, well, here you go. You know, and I called my sister and I just told her what happened. And I was so upset. I was so upset about it because it was embarrassing and it was disappointing because, you know, my dad had been doing so great. So he left. I called his girlfriend immediately. I told her what happened because his girlfriend has been sober for like 3 years and she's great. So I called her and told her what happened. And Jamie, this isn't who he is. I'm like, I know that he's my dad. I've known him my whole life. I know that that's not who he is, but the things that he does that he just did was unacceptable. And I just want to let you know, because I want to make sure that he's getting home safe. Yeah. And that was it. And that's it. And I didn't talk to him for a few days. He called me or texted me or something like 5 days later and was like apologizing profusely. So sorry, so ashamed of himself. And you know, at that point, then that's when you start to feel guilty. Because they feel so bad. They feel so guilty. But you just have to be as understanding and as graceful as possible. Let them know that you still love them. You always love them. But it's so disappointing.
Yeah.
And to be an adult child of an alcoholic sometimes feels like, I said previously, that you're the parent and you're just like disappointed in your kid.
Yeah.
Who can't get out of their own way.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, and you can feel their pain.
Absolutely. And I can feel their pain. Yeah, I can feel their pain in so many ways. I can feel their pain that they don't have a great relationship with their grandkids, that our relationships are broken with their own kids, all of us. It's not the same. It hasn't been the same for a long time. And, you know, thank God I have my brother and sister who have been such like the best support system. We really are able to talk these things out and kind of anytime an incident happens, we keep each other in the loop because, you know, what happens normally is one parent will go to the next kid and the next kid and the next kid. And it's just almost like a game, like a manipulation game.
Yeah. So I know with families that may not have alcoholism in their family, like if you talk to like I think I had joked before we started recording, you can throw a stone and hit at least three people that have been affected by alcoholism in some way. But we don't talk about it enough to realize that and take the stigma away. But if you haven't had any personal relationships with someone that's an alcoholic, you may not have a full understanding of the disease and its nature and that it's a family disease and just how pervasive it is. So what would you want people to understand about how, you know, how you view what's going on with your parents?
I think that addiction as a whole, as you touched on, is the stigma is so, so strong and it needs to be almost normalized. And the fact that it needs to be talked about. And people need to realize that it affects so many people than we know. And with my parents, the challenges that I face, you know, we have to just, I just have to learn to deal with loving them and really just understanding that sometimes it's a choice, but the choice to go overboard isn't there. So the choice to take that first drink is there, but the choice to keep drinking isn't there. And so many things come up with why addicts are addicts. There's underlying depressions and PTSDs and childhood trauma. So we don't know what people are dealing with on the inside. We don't know what people have, what they're trying to self-medicate. But addiction is hard in so many ways. There's no rhyme or reason why it happens to one person and it doesn't happen to the next. Yeah. And so for someone that isn't an addict, it is so hard to understand an addict. So hard. And unless you have gone to the rehab therapies, gone to the lessons that teach you about why it is, like, what goes on chemically in the brain of an addict, like how addiction and how alcoholism changes the chemical makeup of the brain and drugs as well. You don't get it. You just, why are they doing that? Why can't they just stop?
Right. Yeah. And I feel like we do need better education on understanding that as a whole of our society, because then we're able to actually empathize and find true solutions and fund solutions and, you know, just have a way better understanding of taking away that stigma, because it isn't just a person choosing to live a very destructive life because of the kicks and giggles of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, like you said, empathy is a huge thing. Coping is a huge thing.
Having
the tools to be able to set the boundaries. You know, a lot of times children of alcoholics like grow up and they do not have any healthy boundaries, and they are severe codependents, and they are constantly seeking validation and attention from other people. And then they end up getting into unhealthy relationships themselves. And so to have these coping mechanisms in place and education of, like, you know, how to have a relationship with someone who's an addict, I think that things would change so much, you know, because they're everywhere. People are addicted to everything, alcohol, drugs, food, you know, there's so many different forms of addiction.
Right. Yeah. And knowing that there's underlying reasons, usually, you know, PTSD, like you said, trauma, mental illness, all of those things underneath the surface that are also interacting with the chemical imbalance of that person's likelihood to take on an addictive behavior, create some, like, a bad cocktail of circumstances that it's very hard for them to pull themselves out of by conscious choice.
Yeah.
And they need help because they are sick, but it's very hard for them to see that as well, because they seem to still have, like, that conscious side of it still there saying, I have choice, I can do this, I still know what to do, but they can't seem to be able to do it. And that, you know, deteriorates their own self-image and self-esteem as well. So they're still not going to even believe that maybe even help is out there or if it's going to work. So it's very complicated and layered to be that person, but to also love someone that is struggling in that way, to be able to relate and empathize and share the love that they need while wanting them to get help and not always working or being the time that it's going to stick.
Absolutely. And, you know, with addiction comes lying, and with addiction comes manipulation.
Yep.
And so it's not just addiction. It's not just the substance. It's everything else that comes with it.
Yeah.
And I think that, like I've said before, you know, we just need to have as much empathy and grace as possible in dealing with someone and loving someone as an addict, as loving them for who they are, despite that addiction. And like you had said and mentioned, like, loving my parents and remembering my parents for who they were before this happened and before the addiction grasped them and took them away, because mm-hmm. they are not who they were when I grew up. I want nothing more for them to become that person. But at a certain time, you have to let go of those that past and realize that that's not happening. It mm-hmm. probably will never happen. So what I can do is love them, remember and love and cherish those amazing memories. Never forget to tell my kids about them. Never mm-hmm. stop talking about them and move forward to the best of my ability, keeping my family and me safe.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like they still love you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know even they do. Though, being a mom.
They continually disappoint you. Yeah.
Being a mom, I know that love will never go away.
Mm-hmm.
And the disappointment is part of the addiction, the alcohol. Right.
Yeah.
So they don't want to. They don't want to disappoint me. But
yeah.
They do.
The lying and the manipulation can look like intentional harm, but usually it's a coping mechanism on top of a coping mechanism, because they care so much and that love is still there, that they hate to hurt the people that they know are being hurt by their actions. And so they're trying to problem solve around it, mm-hmm. you know, and like create this like whirlwind around them of trying to make it not hurt the people, but it inevitably does and makes it worse.
Yeah.
But it really is, it's never out of like vicious intent to harm. It's usually that they are so hurt inside and know that they're hurting and feel so much guilt for how they're affecting the people around them that they love, that they just feel so over their head.
Absolutely. It's like that expression, just like keep digging a hole. They just keep digging. And it digs and yeah. digs and digs and digs. Sometimes they can get out a little bit, but then they just keep digging. And so
you
just have to remember that. And they don't want to hurt us. They love us, our kids, their grandkids. They love their grandkids more than anything. And that's the hardest part about addiction, is it affects so many families. It hurts. Addiction hurts.
Mm-hmm. So what resources did you find? Did you go to any support groups, read any books, talk to anybody?
So I read The Codependent No More. I read that when my dad first went to rehab years ago. My sister and my brother, obviously, they've been my biggest support system. And my husband, thank God for him every day. He has been just a godsend, and he really keeps my head level and really tries to keep me kind through this situation. Mm-hmm. My father-in-law is always been the same way. Just, they love you. You love them. Just be kind. That's, you know, that's your number one thing you can do. Like, those are your parents. And I'm like, I know, but you don't understand. But you know, people around you that are constantly reminding you and instilling in you to have that grace, keep that love. Al-Anon, I've been to a couple Al-Anon meetings. Those were eye-opening years ago. Mm-hmm. So those are helpful. The Adult Children of Alcoholics website, you can read through that all day. And so that's really, really helpful. But other than that, like, I would say I've just found most of my strength within my family, within my brother and sister, because we do go through the same thing. Our mm-hmm. situation is so unique to so many other people, because like I said before, like, our parents weren't like this growing up. Mm-hmm. So for us, we've not only grieved our parents being alcoholics, we've grieved our past, our parents being married. You know, we went through a divorce at like an adult age. And
yeah,
I remember when my parents were first going through divorce, I was talking to my friend Greg, and his parents got divorced when he was much younger. And I said, it was so hard for me. Like, as older, you really understand what's going on. You really grasp it. You hear what's happening. You hear the dirty talk. You hear, like, you know, all the tidbits mm-hmm. in your ears. And I said to him, I said, I wish my parents just would have got divorced when I was younger, so I don't remember any of this. And he's like, no, you don't. He said, your parents raised you. You had a whole family growing up. They built you to be the person that you are today. You have your morals in place. You have your inner compass is aligned. You know who you are as a person, as an adult. and you are better equipped to handle this as an adult than you would be as a child, to where you are so lost and you don't understand. So he's like, no, you don't wish that. He's like, you are good and you are going to be great. And I remember that conversation. I'll never forget that conversation. It was like 9 years ago.
Wow. That is perspective.
Yeah.
Well, any other advice that you have that you feel like you've learned that you can share to maybe a mom that can relate to a strenuous relationship or just regular overwhelm with two toddlers?
Yeah. I think that, you know, with it just being Father's Day and just being Mother's Day, and you see like all the Hallmark commercials of like the moms, and everyone has like these great fancy relationships and they're so beautiful. Like that is so beautiful for them, but not everybody has that. And it's okay to feel sad. It's okay to feel sad that you don't have the relationship that you want and that other people have with their parents. It's okay. Talk to people. Reach out to people around you. Just talk, because you'll realize and understand that this affects way more people than you think it does. There's probably a lot of your friends out there that are affected by alcoholism one way or another, you know, aunt, uncle, grandparent, mom, dad, husband, sister. It's all there, and addiction is out there, and it's real, and people need support to be able to cope with it. Even if you just, hey, can I just talk to you about something? My best friend Sarah is the best. She just listens. She'll just listen. And that's sometimes what you need. You just need someone to listen. And just know that, you know, you're not alone in addiction. Being a victim of addiction and someone that is an addict can be really lonely. And it can make you feel really hurt. And just know that the best thing that you can do is just try to be kind and love them. And just set your boundaries, make sure you're safe, make sure your kids are safe, make sure your family's safe, but try not to give up on them. I think that's very important as well.
Really wise advice. Really wise.
I still don't have it all figured out yet. It's an everyday thing. You know, it's everyday battle. Every day is different. You know, 1 week's great. The next week isn't. 1 month's great. The next month isn't. And so it is ever evolving, ever changing. And so are my feelings on it, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's okay to have righteous anger or be grieving or be in denial or like be bouncing around those seven stages of grief at any point. Absolutely. And yeah, that's normal. That's expected. That's it. You have every right to. You know, you don't have to keep a perfect facade just because you're a mom to two kids that you have to, you know, communicate it perfectly. You're human and you're sad and you're mad, and that's okay.
Yeah. And I think having the kids, the most important thing that I can do is encourage their relationship with them. Don't talk bad about them. Well, in front of them at least.
Yeah.
You know, if you have to use code names, you know, if you're having a conversation and the kid is within earshot.
Yeah.
But I think that the number one thing is to just stay positive with your children. Make sure that they know that their grandparents are loved and that, you know, you love their relationship with them. Talk about them. Talk about the good times. I tell my son a story every night before we go to bed. And one of them is always usually when I was a child, when I was a little girl. And they're real stories and he loves them. And they bring me a sense of peace and they bring me like a joy that, you know, to say something that I haven't thought about in a while that was a fantastic memory in my life. So I think no matter what, just keeping that, those memories and keeping those good feelings alive, and making sure that your kids know that their grandparents are loved. They might not be around as much, but they're loved.
Yeah. I love that. So the last question that I ask every guest that comes on is, how are you the mom that your kids need?
I ask myself that question every day. I show up for my kids even when things are really hard. I try my best to do better every day. and to really improve on my skills as a mom, as a wife, as a friend every single day to set the best example I can for them. Mm-hmm. I love those kids more than I ever thought I could ever love anything in my life. And I know they say that love is not enough, that you have to do more. But if you go to bed every night knowing that tomorrow you're going to try to do more or trying to do more when you wake up in the morning, I think that you're winning. You're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And when your kids see you trying, when you're on the floor playing with them, when you let them cook the banana bread that they just spilled half of the container of cinnamon in, it's fine. You know, we're all going to be okay. And when my son looks up at me and says, "I'm sorry, it's okay, buddy. It's fine. It's totally fine. We're all going to make it. It's a day-to-day thing. And my kids are my life." And I think that putting them at the center of your life and making sure that they are safe and loved and well taken care of and understood mm-hmm. is the most important thing.
Yes. Preach. Your kids are lucky to have you. You're an outstanding mom and an amazing daughter as well. Thank you so much for your honesty in sharing such a sensitive aspect of your life. But I know that it will help a lot of other families that are navigating similar circumstances, and I just really will love to not feel so alone with that.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you. Are you able to look at boundaries in a whole new light? I hope so. Jamie is such an inspiring example of an intentional mom who knows her role. Be empowered to trust your gut and draw a necessary boundary. You can do hard things. Next episode will be a short "Why We're Failing" episode, so check back and don't miss it. Do you feel like you're getting beat down by 2020? I'm here to pick you up off the floor, dust you off, and send you back swinging. You can do these hard things, but sometimes we need to ask for help to get there. Go to parentingwholeheartedly.com/coaching to learn more about how I can help and schedule a free call today. Thanks for coming on this journey with me. I believe in you, and I'm cheering you on.